Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio, a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to the life science and patient advocacy communities. I'm Annalee Smith, Marketing Manager of the Partnership Opportunities in Drug Delivery, or POD, program. Today's show is a panel discussion from POD 2017 entitled Hitting the Reset Button on Direct-to-CNS Delivery. The talk is introduced by PJ Anand from Alcyon Life Sciences and moderated by Dr. Lisa Schaefer at Teva Pharmaceuticals. Panelists include Dr. Dan Abrams from Cerebral Therapeutics, Dr. Krzysztof Bankiewicz at UCSF, Dr. Mikhail Papasov of Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Lamia Shayabuddin from Sanofi R&D. They discuss the difficult nature of providing therapies for diseases of the CNS, covering both device and chemistry-enabled technologies.
Happy Friday, everybody. We are only a few hours away from the Friday happy hour. This is near and dear to me, this particular conversation that's going to happen. And I'm going to start with my recent trip to Japan. So I took the bullet train. It was fantastic, you know, hundreds of miles. It was just from Kyoto to Tokyo. Then I take the train here from Boston to New York, the Sela Express. Beautiful, shiny train, cut silver inside. You get liquor, you get food, it's very nice inside. But yet, it goes 60, 70 miles for a short period of time, and it's rickety, it's shaky, then it slows down, right? So both are fast trains and expresses. It's kind of a little bit of an analogy that I think about what's happened to CNS drug development, right? And most of the time, we seldom ever talk about the power of timing, right? So, and this is true for antibodies, oligos. Today, these are multi-billion-dollar drugs, but there was a time where people tried to, you know, move it across. You know, there were setbacks. So what excites me is really a couple of things, you know, timing. You know, timing in one, but few things. And what you're looking at, the people in this panel here represent a handful of qualities that results in effective therapy development. So you can peddle a drug or you can develop a therapy. And there is distinct differences between that. And I think biopharma has done a wonderful job moving away from just developing drugs and moving into developing therapies. Go to the next slide. So we have a panel here that's going to talk about historical context as well as where we are in terms of what are the challenges and why they think maybe the timing is now, right? So I think this is going to be, personally for me, I think one of the most interesting discussions that we'll get to hear. And a component of that is not just from a technical perspective, but also from a business perspective. And what is it that makes this particular panel incredibly powerful? Maybe starting with Dr. Bankiewicz here, right? It's one of the qualities is true passion and just absolutely undeterred belief that whatever he started doing all the way from NIH to now is important and needed to patients. And there are others in the group here, like Lisa, who managed to convince a company like Medtronic, a medtech company like Medtronic, to see the light here in terms of what needs to be done. And you have Misha, you know, really changing the game by generating data in the intrathecal area. And Dan taking that and building therapeutic value props here. It's really a pretty incredible panel here. And you see the historical context of things that they've done from the 80s coming down all the way now, where, you know, there are companies being founded based on the tools and things that they've contributed to. So a couple of things here, you know, in terms of fresh look, you know, why do we even think about direct to CNS? You know, in many ways, the answer is very simple. There isn't much choices here. You know, we can talk about, you know, blood-brain barriers, and I think that's really important. But one way or another, you need these very elegant tools that I've developed, and nothing as efficient as going directly to the CNS. And I think whether you go talk to Big Pharma or Barbara's of the world, you know, even the Big Pharma has conceded that there are diseases and therapies where this is basically necessary. So this is somewhat self-explanatory, right? How do we go directly to the CNS? You can drill a hole in the head, or you can use the CSF, right? And or you can go ICV, you know, fairly straightforward, safe. I mean, think about it. There are about 2 million people walking around with deep brain stimulation leads, right? And it's safe, seem to work. So a little terminology here to make the panel a little more seamless. You know, intracerebral, you know, you guys know where it is, and where it goes, intrathecal to the spinal column, interparenchymal directly into the tissue, and, you know, port versus pumps. You know, all this is fairly straightforward, but thought this visual will help you guys get everything in context so the conversation can be rapid. So here are some of the enabling technologies. So on the far right, you see a very elegant technology from the doctor, great Dr. Vogelbaum of Cleveland Clinic. You know, not just a great surgeon, but a consummate inventor and a terrific company, Infusion. You should definitely have a conversation if you haven't had yet. You see his technology for high volume infusions, and you know, and then you see Chris's work with ClearPoint and his system going directly in the brain and doing some phenomenal work in Parkinson's and beyond. Needless to say, he's also founded Voyager Therapeutics. And then you see me peddling our AMC cannula here, which is also, I think, is the best thing since sliced bread. And then we're talking about intrathecal modalities here, right? The very idea that, you know, if you really want to design drugs for CNS, I would get a really good understanding not only about the CNS chemistries or the CSF chemistries, and you could actually formulate the drug based on what is it that would work best in the CSF space versus taking a drug that's either given orally or, you know, systemically and try to just make a liquid form and inject it. And the very idea of intrathecal modalities, you know, can be much better, I think, is getting validated as companies like Biogen are putting a stake in the ground through intrathecal delivery. So much credit to them, as well as much work also done in gene therapy. And here is the what I think is a rock star panel when we talk about CNS direct delivery. And I'm going to hand it to, I think, one of the most talented moderators in the world, Lisa Schaefer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, PJ. And thank you all for being here. I know it's towards with the second to last session on the second day, so appreciate all of you still in attendance. So what I'd like to start out with doing is have each of the panelists give a brief introduction of themselves and their work as relevant to direct to CNS. I'll just say really quickly for me, as Barbara mentioned, I spent several years at Medtronic and was really enamored by the opportunities that would be afforded by a fully implantable, programmable drug delivery system. I came to this conference probably about 5 years ago because I said I read it and said drug delivery. I said that's the fully implantable, programmable pump that's been in use for many years for intrathecal delivery for chronic pain. And I got here and I was just floored that it wasn't anything about that. It was entirely different. So I want to make sure that we're, because I think now, fast forward several years, or about 5 years, I think it's much more relevant. And we're seeing, as PJ mentioned, the Biogen, which is the intrathecal acute delivery. But the pump I was talking about was an implantable, programmable, continuous infusion system. There was two presentations yesterday, one by the CEO, Larry, back there, of Flowonix, another programmable implantable pump company for intrathecal delivery, but as you'll hear, being used for other sites of delivery to the brain. And I think, really interesting, not only just recent, but folks that have been working in this field for many years and have really been the founders of this field that I have the great fortune to be working with. So I'll pause there and hope each of you introduce yourselves, and then I have some questions not only for you guys, but also for the panelists, and then welcome your questions.
I can Is this working? Okay. So I'm Lamia Shahabuddin. I head the genetic CNS diseases at Sanofi. And we've been working on developing therapies for CNS indications. And as you heard, it is quite a challenge to deliver therapeutics to CNS. So we've been working on delivering enzymes, genes, as well as antisense oligonucleotides for various CNS indications, and we have collaborated and used several of the delivery strategies, and we currently have collaborations with Crescent Voyager on delivering gene therapy for CNS indications.
Thank you. I'm Dan Abrams. I'm the CEO of Cerebral Therapeutics. I got into this because as a neurosurgeon, I had put in over 100 pumps myself for patients with refractory pain and spasticity. And I'd put medications in the brain for patients with breast cancer, methotrexate to prevent recurrence, and antibiotics in the rare cases when shunts, VP shunts, had gotten infected. So I was fascinated by why was this pill dispenser that works so well for patients with pain and spasticity wasn't being utilized in other areas of significant unmet need. So neurosurgeons do a lot of things, but one of the things we, at least I believe we do, is we focus on patients with serious untreated illnesses. And that really began my journey about being able to do that. And we're very lucky. We're right now in a clinical study where we have 6 patients who intracerebroventricular administration of anti-epileptic medications has changed their course. The business history is obviously part of the complexity. So we're very fortunate to work with Flowonix. Flowonix is an outstanding company and outstanding collaborators and understands the complexity of doing drug and device combinations and working with them together. So it's, I actually really like the slides. So I have never seen that before. So thank you, PJ, wherever you are, or thank you, Lisa. It's just great slides. But anyway, it's a big honor to be here, and I wanna thank Pod and thank Lisa and Larry for inviting me, but also to encourage all of you. I think we're in the really beginning phases of a very important journey, and I'm hoping we're gonna start to see brain-approved drugs here as early as 2020, 2021. And the more we have, the more stakes we have in the ground, I believe the therapies will move forward.
I'm Chris Benkevich. I did like the slides a lot, except I guess I realized that I'm from the previous century and still working.
80s are cool. The 80s are really cool.
I'm a professor of neurosurgery and neurology at UCSF, and I got into this field, I think, in mid-80s, I suppose. And I think the whole idea of getting things across blood-brain barrier, appeared pretty straightforward at that time. And then we realized that it just takes a lot of effort to really do it in a manner that can actually become a medical procedure rather than an experiment. So I think the biggest lesson I've learned, I guess, was that we tried to take off-the-shelf kind of things and put them all together and hope that we can deliver therapeutic agents directly to the brain. And that, I think, clearly has not worked very well. And I think the whole idea of having a reset button now, I think it's something I completely can relate to. I think there's a lot of effort that went into trying to develop this technology prematurely, and I think we've had probably more failures than I guess successes, and hopefully this will change now, and I think we'll discuss it here. But having said that, I've been involved in creating a number of devices now, such as reflux resistant cannulis, some of the platforms for the stereotactic placement, just trying to see why I could not ever reproduce what I've been trying to do in terms of the brain delivery in some of the experimental animals. So Having said that, you know, we have at least four or five clinical trials now that do involve direct administration of therapeutics to the brain, and I'm more than happy to discuss it with you, and hopefully we can discuss it during the panel as well.
I am Misha Papisov. By my original education, I'm a chemist. By trade, since 1982, I am a drug deliverist, if you will. I have a lab at Mass General, and the way we operate, we study poorly understood or misunderstood biological, physiological transport processes. And once we think that we understand something new, we try to make a drug model or a drug carrier or improve the existing therapeutic in a way so that this therapeutic would be able to ride on this newly described transport processes. And in that, my knowledge in chemistry helps. And so we are kind of working in waves. We study physiology, then we switch to making prototype drugs. And for the last 8 or 9 years, we've been working in the area of intrathecal drug delivery. It started from a question from my friends in the industry, Shire, actually, which I thought was very strange. They came and said, you know, we are developing a protein which should go to the brain, but it doesn't. Why don't we try to inject it intrathecally, lumbarly, in monkey and see if it accumulates in the brain? And so, and I was like, guys, I remember the physiology book. You know, what are you talking about? But anyway, we tried. And to my amazement, that protein injected in the lower lumbar area went up and accumulated deep in the brain structures. And so it was obvious that all those pictures that you see in the physiology books and even in relatively recent review papers are just totally incorrect with respect to what is transported to where, about all these flows, when, where you inject the drug. And it turned out we kind of understand almost the entire picture now, and we are starting the publication process. We will be publishing papers one by one, but I am already ready to share with you all that we found out. I can tell you from the physiological point of view that the way from the needle or catheter to way deep inside the brain or spinal cord is open. It's not entirely open. There are things that need to be taken into account. But for potent pharmaceuticals, for biopharmaceuticals, it's interesting that sometimes it's easier to deliver a very large molecule deep into the brain than a small molecule. And this is kind of the opposite of what we are used to in systemic pharmacology. Then again, let us talk.
Great, thank you. So I think you'll see we have you know, everything from physiology, serial entrepreneurs, neurosurgeons, big industry, big pharma, big device, now big pharma for me. So you know, a well-rounded panel. But I'd like to ask a question of all of you. So by show of hands, who is interested or currently treating CNS diseases? Who is in the CNS therapy space? Okay. Great, thank you. So the rest of you, this may be a little out of your realm, but hopefully it teaches you new things or resets some of the myths, I think, that are associated to Misha's points, you know, that when you think, when you look at like the Netter, for those of you that were trained in the sciences or in medical, you look at the Netter textbooks, the anatomy textbooks, and it shows CSF going with little arrows around the spinal column. And if only it were that easy, right? And it flowed, and all the flow dynamics were exactly as those pictures suggest. And what we know to be true now, thanks to, I think, a lot more research and well, you know, going back to Chris's early work and others over the last, more than 10 years, that's just not that simple, and each drug is different. So I want to talk to that, and when I ask the questions, we'll speak to that. And when we talk through the questions, differentiating between what is true and known in the intrathecal versus intracerebral ventricular versus intraparenchymal, IT, ICV, IPA. So for those of you that this is newer or you're not in the CNS, those are, we'll switch back and forth between those compartments, intrathecal being the area around the cord, intracerebroventricular being the fluid-filled ventricles in the brain, and intraparenchymal being the tissue. These are important because the diseases that one might focus or choose to target those particular compartments are associated with that anatomy. So for instance, pain, most of the targets for pain are in the spinal cord, therefore intrathecal, or ALS, disease of the cord, for the most part. Although I look to my medical friends for verification of that. Versus things like more diffuse diseases such as epilepsy or maybe even Alzheimer's, that wherein the ICV may be a more appropriate compartment to target or to deliver into. And then finally, the intraparenchymally for things like Huntington's or Parkinson's or glioblastoma in Chris's world. So we'll start with a question. So we kind of just set this up as true or false, and we can get into debates if there's people from the audience that feel very differently than anything you hear up here. But true or false, encapsulation or conjugation technologies or chemistry approaches should be able to achieve adequate blood-brain barrier penetration and distribution if the target is IT, ICV, or IPA. So in your response, just make sure you're defining which compartment. So conjugation technologies and approaches should be, or chemistry technologies should be able to achieve adequate blood-brain barrier penetration and distribution. Who wants to start? Michelle?
Just a question to clarify this. When we talk about blood-brain barrier, it's usually we are talking about IV, right? Are we talking about still IV administration or IT, ICV, and so on?
You make the differentiation in what your science shows in your response.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
Okay.
Good question.
I believe the first attempts to shuttle large molecules through the blood-brain barrier from the IV side, from the blood side, the first attempts were kind of successful in early 90s, right? And a certain degree, certain fraction of the dose was transported to the brain. And I think that fraction was in the area of below 1%. Okay. And it was very exciting. I just remember reading that paper. And it didn't move up since then. And I am talking about the transcytosis-mediated transport on transferrin receptors and so on. Now, from the cerebrospinal fluids, obviously with the direct delivery, you deliver your entire dose into the parenchyma. If you deliver it focally, where your device is sitting, right, where the device is open, with the IT delivery in any form, cerebrospinal fluid mediated, you deliver through the entire system, and the total fraction of the delivered dose is much higher than with intravenous route. And then again, from what we see, the efficacy of the delivery will depend on conjugation, modification, and so on. My thinking is now that conventional drugs, not specifically developed for IT delivery, will work very poorly. And they did. I mean, there were several clinical trials with frontline drugs. None of them worked. Now, based on the mechanisms, we know why they didn't work. We know what will work. We know what is already working and why. So the answer for IT is yes. And probably for parenchymal, I didn't work much on the intraparenchymal injection. But based on what I know, they should. They should.
Well, I would say it's true and false. In other words, it really depends on the context you're going to put this, the whole question. There's a lot of beautiful work that has been done in trying to use the active blood-brain barrier transport mechanism by conjugating, using you know, whatever system you want to use for getting things across the blood-brain barrier. But you know, I just want to step back here for a second, and that is, you know, the reason we're having this debate and the reason many of us are in this field is that, you know, we don't believe that the treatment strategy as we try to develop for the brain delivery really is working well if you flood the whole organism with a drug. In other words, you know, if you try to cross blood-brain barrier by giving systemic administration or even intrathecal, and you end up with a lot of drug actually leaving the brain, I mean, that is an issue because you may deal with the systemic toxicity. And, you know, now we're getting into nanoparticles, viral vectors, I think complex molecules. So this is something that, for a number of reasons, we may want to try to avoid. In other words, try to really get the drug into the brain directly. And then if you take it one step further, you know, you may want to only affect a small portion of the brain that is involved in the disease process. And again, flooding the whole brain with a very potent therapeutic is going to end up with the side effects. So that speaks highly for the direct intraparenchymal delivery. One example would be, for example, you know, GBM. So you have brain tumors where you try to really affect a specific part of the brain and where you have the malignant disease. And, you know, the saying is that, you know, we have very powerful drugs and we could use them systemically to kill the tumor, but we may also do the same thing to the patient, right? So you want to direct this treatment to the area that actually has the best chances of working. And the same goes for, you know, some of the disorders, such as you mentioned Huntington's, for example, and others. So you want to restrict this treatment to the specific part of the brain. So then intraparenchymal delivery, it's fine. But, you know, this conjugation chemistry, I think, is very wide, I guess, issue, because you can really come up with the very complex molecules that will just not cross the blood-brain barrier, but yet could, let's say, you know, work on a specific receptor and deliver the payload to specific cell types. So I don't think we have all the answers, but I think we know what doesn't work already, which I think it's already a good advance in the field.
So contrary to all appearances, I was good on multiple choice tests, but I won't choose true or false. I would say that the answer is maybe. But I think there's a question behind this question that's important. For a long time, people were thinking through that IV-administered medications, that there would be a trick to be a Trojan horse or a conjugation onto those molecules administered systemically would allow transport across the endothelium to increase the amount of drug administered systemically. And I think one of the ideas behind this question, I could be wrong, but I think one of the ideas behind this question is the solution to penetration in the brain these conjugation chemistry strategies? And what I would say is it may be, but as far as I know, we haven't proven it yet. And so I still believe there's a potential that conjugation chemistries administered systemically will be able to get right doses into the brain for things that we need, including the larger molecules that were showed so nicely on that several generation evolved slide. Having said that, I will go to Misha's point and Chris's point. We're not there yet. And so I'm a pragmatist. The question is how do we optimize the tools that we have in order to build a therapy that can be helping patients now with good clinical outcomes? So the simple answer is maybe, but that's not what I do, and so far it hasn't been proven to me that that's a doable strategy that will be successful. But anybody who's working on it, I encourage them to do that because I do think there's a potential for it.
So, okay. So it is actually also for me, it's not a true or false, because while the question here is posed whether conjugation chemistry will allow you to cross the blood-brain barrier, currently it allows you to cross the blood-brain barrier some. Is it sufficient to be therapeutic? We're not there yet. However, all the IT, ICV, IPA, you already circumvented the blood-brain barrier, so that's not what we're talking about. So there are conjugations that, combined with ITICV-IPA, will enhance distribution as well as proper cellular targeting. So combining these approaches, conjugation and chemistry, plus choosing the drug delivery is essential to basically target your therapy because, as Chris mentioned, sometimes you don't want your therapeutic to go all over the place because it can create a safety concern. So while you want it to distribute locally when you inject it into the brain, but you also might want to restrict it to specific cell type in the brain, again, either to limit toxicity or to increase uptake and efficacy. So that said, we're getting there. There is a lot of advances in conjugation chemistry, first to cross the blood-brain barrier as well as to appropriate targeting, but each should be tested with the appropriate method of delivery by knowing your disease and where you want to deliver.
And can I add one thing upon this? Because, the important thing is to understand that at micro level, these pathways from the blood and from extracellular fluid in the parenchyma and from the perivascular space after the IND injection, at the micro level, these ways don't come exactly to the same places. So you may expect that you take the same molecule, let's say a conjugate targeted to some cells, and in an imaginary situation that from each pathway you deliver exactly this, let's say you deliver 1% of the dose through IV, the same 1% through IT, maybe a little more through intraparenchymal, but you are delivering them at the microscopic level to the different places in the parenchyma. From IV, you deliver them through the capillary wall. That's where the transcytosis is. From the IT route, your drug exits the perivascular channels mostly at the ends of the arteries, arterioles. It's not the same place. When your drug diffuses or assisted diffuses, can I use this term, right, in the parenchyma, it still may be through some channels in the brain, and the microstructure of those conduits is not known yet. So in the end, the same drug will be coming from kind of different backyards, and it may be coming more effectively to one cell type rather than another, or it may be coming to one cell subpopulation module of the brain from IT route more effectively than from IV and so on. So it makes sense to try all routes, at least to see to which cells your drug is coming to.
Great. So best scientific answer, it depends, right? Depends on the molecule, depends on the compartment, and depends on the use situation. So with that, PJ and I, when we were talking about setting this up, want to be very careful to not, for lack of a better word, alienate on the chemistry side, and yet there's a lot in these forums discussions on the chemistry and the chemistry technologies, and wanted to make sure that we were bringing into the conversation some of the implantable device technologies, or not necessarily even, implantable, whether it's acute or chronic, but that which requires a surgery. So one thing that I've often heard, and it's coming from a device, kind of growing up in a device company, you lose sight of or lose a little perspective on what may or may not be conceived as or perceived as invasive. So to me, you wouldn't think of not getting a pacemaker if you needed it. It's an implantable, but it's so common. Same with a shunt, an ICV shunt, if you're hydrocephaly or normal pressure hydrocephaly. So we wanted to bring into the conversation on what is perceived as invasive when you have drugs that go throughout the body and quite honestly stay, right, in some cases, depending on their PK, but go throughout the body. And then you have the device that stays in a body, whether it's acute or chronic. So the next question, the invasiveness and surgical risk of a device-mediated approach can and should limit its utility, true or false? And is your response different if it's intrathecal, intracerebroventricular, or intraparenchymal? So I'll start with a neurosurgeon, how about? And in other neurosurgeons, we have another infusion. Dr. Vogelbaum, if you're still in the audience too, feel free to jump in. All right, so start with Chris. What do you think?
Thinking about it, actually. You know, any drug is invasive. I mean, so I guess we need to start from that. Having said that, obviously, you always have to deal with the risk-benefit ratio here, right? And that's something you have to keep in mind. And I guess, developing devices and, your clinical approaches, I mean, you have to keep that in mind always. So just, from simple perspective of, what it takes to do IT, ICV, or IPA, the intraparenchymal infusion appears to be, obviously the most invasive one, because that's going to involve direct brain penetration of the devices, and it's obviously involves some more elaborate, obviously, surgical procedure than just putting a cannula or catheter into lumbar space, for example, right? So that's pretty obvious. Most of neurosurgeons obviously have been trained to do the shunt, so I think intraventricular infusions, they also probably not incredibly invasive at this point, but involve placement of the devices. And one thing that one has to keep in mind is that obviously you have issues with the chronically implanted devices in the human body. So the longer they stay, the more likely you may get some issues with infection. There are a number of approaches where you actually have a device implanted and you want to do repeated administration. So there obviously there are a couple of things coming to mind. And I think, with all the work that has been done with the delivery of baclofen or morphine into the intrathecal space, there are issues as it relates to the reaction of the body to the drug being given chronically, right? So those catheters may get occluded. There may be issues as it relates to the tissue responses to the drugs being given. So I mean, that's something one has to keep in mind. I all heard of calls about a lot of dramatic issues as it relates to the problems with loading the infusion pumps with the drug, like morphine, for example. I mean, there's a lot of people that got hurt because of technology, if you will, of how you load these things. So I mean, that obviously is a huge risk. I guess it resulted in some of the black labels on some of those devices. So I don't think there's an easy answer here. I think, again, if you have the situation when you're dealing with a child that has a brain tumor in the brainstem, then obviously that's a different situation than someone that has, diabetes and, wants to get a morphine, I mean, sorry, the insulin pump, right? So I think CNS, it's always going to be this issue of, with whom you're going to be dealing and, what's the risk-benefit ratio. But all of them are going to be invasive, either devices or the compounds that you're going to be giving in a high concentration in a limited, space. So, for example, directly parenchymal administration is going to have a different risk than, other things like shunts, for example.
We'll go in decreasing age. Professor Vogelbaum.
That's only about a year, I think, is what I
can't hear you, but...
Now it's on. So so it's only a year difference there. But we'll go with that. I just want to build on Chris's points, because neurosurgeons, we've been putting things in the brain and in the central nervous system for decades, and this is routinely done. So the actual process of inserting a device, whether it's temporary or permanent, the risks are very, very low, and it's very well understood. Really, where the risk of infection becomes an issue is when you then have to access that device on a routine basis. So when you have to refill a baclofen pump, when you Ommaya reservoirs, when you go to tap that, or for the short-term tubes that we put in the brain for a variety of reasons, if they're left in for too long. And there are ways to mitigate that risk. But ultimately, it's when you're accessing it, not when you're putting it in, that is the issue. And you know, I'm a tumor surgeon, but I have my colleagues who do functional neurosurgery. Their OR day is pretty well structured and stereotypical in that in the mornings they go ahead and put in deep brain stimulator leads. And then after lunch, they do battery changes for deep brain stimulators. And then in the early evening, they start taking out infected baclofen pumps and infected leads. So that's just part of their normal course of affairs. That said, the risks associated with these chronic devices are quite low in terms of the rates of infection. The less you have to access them, the better. For the short-term devices, like the ones that Chris and I have been using, really, with the implantations and the infusions, the infections directly associated with that, or hemorrhages or other things, have been very, very low. We've been involved in most of the trials that have been going on. That's not really been a major issue for those trials.
So I will build on, I agree with what both Chris and Mike have to say, but I want to answer it slightly differently. So the invasiveness and surgical risks absolutely should limit its utility. Not limit its utility, but limit its utilization. So I think you were in the room when we had this discussion in 2006 and 8. There was a large company that basically said, hey, can't you do this for depression? You know, there are like so many patients with depression. There are 30 million patients with depression. Shouldn't you do this with depression? And I thought that was the wrong thing to answer. And it really builds on Mike and Chris's comments in a very simple way. It's all about the calculation of the risk-benefit. These all have small but acceptable risks if the disease itself has a greater risk and all other options have been tried. And when you develop it, that is, I'm going to put on the drug developer hat, when you develop it, you have to really be retentive that you have the lowest complication risk possible. And I also build on what Mike just said, but was implied in what Chris said. It's very different for chronic therapies than acute therapies. For acute therapies, we figured it out, all the reasons they've said. For chronic therapies, we've also had a lot of success with intrathecal pumps that Larry knows well and that Lisa knows well from Teva, from Medtronic and Flowonix. But still, when you're developing a new therapy, you really have to be compulsive that the risk is very acceptable because everybody, including FDA and commercially and the payers and the patients, all will want to calculate that risk. So sorry to be so absolute about it, but it's one of the areas I have very big passion about.
So I'm not a neurosurgeon, obviously, but I think I will reiterate it's the risk-benefit ratio. But I have, while I may agree with you about depression and, you know, repeat administrations, but there are diseases, for example, what Biogen is going after, which are spinal muscular atrophy, as well as Roche is going after Huntington with antisense oligonucleotides, which is a very, very chronic disease, and it's going to require repeat administration. And the presence of these delivery devices are critical for continuous delivery, basically for repeat administration, because again, not every time they're going to show up, you want to prep the OR to access the intrathecal as much as you want to have probably a port or a pump where you can put your therapy. But that said, there is the limitation of the drug that you're going to deliver, because then you really have to try to understand the stability, the volume that you need to deliver, which you need to design your devices to account for that. So.
Yeah, I was thinking, actually I was thinking from my experience in a startup several years ago, drug development. So I saw this process from a company side once. And it's interesting that with basically almost the same thing, if you want to run a clinical study, you come to an oncologist who is supposed to run the study, and oncologist says, well, what's your MTD? Let's go from MTD and double. And you come to a neurologist, and neurologist says, well, MTD is this, let's start from 100th of it and slowly go up. And it's already in the culture. Now, with these types of drug delivery, you have another person involved, which is a neurosurgeon. And neurosurgeon has his or her own understanding of extra risks. And the degree of these risks probably depend on the equipment, and the equipment is in active development and will have safer and safer and better equipment. But I have a question to Chris. When we speak about risks and invasiveness and risks in neurosurgery, where exactly those risks come from? Is it from the procedure of drilling the skull, or is it from the risk of some catheter that is made maybe not of an ideal material, or there are unknown risks that we should study, and we don't?
Can I answer that one
sure.
first?
Yeah.
Yeah, the answer is yes. You gave a list of things where the risk can come from. They actually come from all of them. And that's part of the development process, is to balance the proof of principle and then optimize the therapy so you work through it. And that's why I'm a big proponent of clinical data, mm-hmm. because the clinical data tells you this isn't working. Okay, you gotta fix this, you gotta modify this. So you could have a catheter problem, you can have a pump problem, you can have a drug problem, you can have a compatibility problem, you can have a site of onset. And even though we're building on well-established safe things, each change can make a difference. And so you have to have both the drivenness to move forward, but also the flexibility to optimize. And I think FDA recognizes that. Once you get to proof of principle, they sometimes expect between phase one and two and three that you're gonna be optimized. And they expect when you get to phase three, you got it all figured out, and you're doing a pre-registration trial. But I think that's part of the optimization. And the goal, right, is not to hurt anybody and still help people in that interval.
Sure, so I just wanna add one more thing. And we started a gene therapy trial in children, the pretty bad genetic disease. So the first case took 12 hours. And that is a huge risk for the patient, right? Being especially a sick child to be anesthetized for that long. But the reason it took so long is because we had to learn. There's a series of procedures that have to go into treating a child like this. And there's another risk, how long it's gonna take you to deliver your drug. And what's the learning curve? I mean, the third patient we just did only took maybe 6 hours. So, there's a huge advance there. But, that immediately makes you think, how can I design the treatment strategy to shorten even further? So as we start thinking about new devices, new procedures, things like that. So, I mean, it's never-ending story. I think it's just to give an impression that we have had over the years for all these different clinical trials, it's a huge learning curve and, training procedure. You have to get not only the devices, but you have to have a know-how that you can translate to a different groups, because, we have only a couple of surgeons that can do that type of procedure. For you as drug developers, I mean, that's of no use, because how many times can you treat your patient? I mean, you want to develop treatment so it's widely used. If you make it too complicated, you over-engineer everything, I mean, that's not going to help developing a new compound. The time is also a risk. It's not just the surgeon, but, how long it takes to do the procedure.
Our legacy as neurosurgeons was Harvey Cushing, who, when he was in your neck of the woods, at first was treating brain tumors. He had a 50% mortality rate in the pre-antibiotic generation. When he was done, when he was done, he had a 3-4%. Took him 10 years to figure that out. We're hoping we learn a lot faster than that, but we include the learning as part of it. It has to be, and it's clinical learning.
The 8th annual POD meeting will be on October 17th and 18th, 2018, in Boston. You can learn more about POD online at www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.